The boy, or man, who is under the power of the other pole of the dysfunctional shadow of the precocious child, the naive dummy, like the weakling prince, lacks personality, vigor, and creativity. He seems unresponsive and dull. He can't seem to learn his multiplication tables, count change, or tell time. He is frequently labeled a slow learner. In addition, he lacks a sense of humor and frequently seems to miss the point of jokes. He may appear to be physically inept as well. His coordination is off, so he often becomes the butt of ridicule and contempt when he fumbles the ball on the playing field or strikes out in the last of the ninth. This boy may also appear to be naive. He is, or seems to be, the last kid on the block to learn about the birds and the bees. The dummy's ineptitude, however, is frequently less than honest. He may grasp far more than he shows, and his dunce-like behavior may mask a hidden grandiosity that feels itself too important as well as too vulnerable to come into the world. Thus, intimately intertwined with a secret know-it-all, the dummy is also a trickster. All the immature masculine energies are overly tied, one way or another, to mother, and are deficient in their experience of the nurturing and mature masculine. Although the boy for whom the Oedipal child is a powerful archetypal influence may be deficient in his experience of the nurturing masculine, he is able to access the positive qualities of the archetype. He is passionate and has a sense of wonder and a deep appreciation for connectedness with his inner depths, with others, and with all things. He is warm, related, and affectionate. He also expresses, through his experience of connectedness to the mother, the primal relationship for almost all of us, the origins of what we call spirituality. His sense of the mystic oneness and mutual communion of all things comes out of his deep yearning for the infinitely nurturing, infinitely good, infinitely beautiful mother. This mother is not his real mother, his mortal mother. She is bound to disappoint him much of the time in his need for connectedness and perfect or infinite love and nurturing. Rather, the mother that he is sensing beyond his own, beyond all the beauty and feeling which the Greeks called eros in the things of the world, and that he is experiencing in the deep feelings and images of his inner life, is the great mother, the goddess in her many forms in the myths and legends of many peoples and cultures.
The Oedipal child's shadow consists of the mama's boy and the dreamer. The mama's boy is, as we all know, tied to mama's apron strings. He causes the boy to fantasize about marrying his mother, about taking her away from his father. If there is no father or a weak father, this so-called Oedipal urge comes on all the stronger, and this crippling side of the Oedipal child's bipolar shadow may possess him. The term Oedipus complex comes from Freud, who saw in the legend of the Greek king Oedipus a mythological account of this immature masculine energy form. The story is familiar. King Laertes and his wife Jocasta had a baby boy whom they named Oedipus. Because of a prophecy that said that Oedipus would grow up to kill his father, Laertes had this special child taken out into the country and exposed on a hillside, where it was assumed the elements would kill him. However, as is always the case with divine boys, Oedipus was rescued. He was found by a shepherd and raised to manhood. One day, as Oedipus was walking down a country road, a chariot nearly ran him down. He got into a fight with the owner of the chariot and killed him. The chariot's owner, unbeknownst to him, was his father Laertes. Oedipus then went on to Thebes, where he learned that the queen was seeking a husband. The queen was Jocasta, his mother. Oedipus married her and took his father's throne. It was only years later, when blight descended upon the kingdom, that the awful truth was uncovered, and Oedipus, the wrongful king, was cast down. The underlying psychological truth in the story is that Oedipus was inflated. He was struck down by the gods for killing his father, the god, and marrying his mother, the goddess. Thus, he was destroyed for the unconscious inflation of his unconscious pretensions to godhood. For every child, from a developmental point of view, mother is the goddess and father is the god. Boys who are too bound to the mother get hurt. There's also the story of Adonis, who became the lover of Aphrodite, the goddess of love. A mortal boy making claims on a goddess could not be tolerated, so Adonis was struck down by a wild boar, really a god in animal form, the father, and killed. Something else happens to the mama's boy. He often gets caught up in chasing the beautiful, the poignant, the yearning for union with mother from one woman to another. He can never be satisfied with a mortal woman, because what he is seeking is the immortal goddess. Here we have the Don Juan syndrome. The Oedipal child, inflated beyond mortal dimensions, cannot be bound to one woman. In addition, the boy under the power of the mama's boy is what is called autoerotic. He may compulsively masturbate. He may be into pornography, seeking the goddess in the nearly infinite forms of the female body. The mama's boy, like all immature energies, wants just to be. He does not want to do what it takes to actually have union with a mortal woman and to deal with all the complex feelings involved in an intimate relationship. He does not want to take responsibility. The other pole of the dysfunctional shadow of the Oedipal child is the dreamer. The dreamer takes the spiritual impulses of the Oedipal child to an extreme. Whereas the boy possessed by the mama's boy also shows signs of passivity, he at least actively seeks mother. The dreamer, however, causes a boy to feel isolated and cut off from all human relationships. For the boy who is under the spell of the dreamer, relationships are with intangible things and with the world of the imagination within him. As a consequence, while other children are playing, he may sit on a rock dreaming his dreams. He accomplishes little and appears withdrawn and depressed. Often his dreams tend to be melancholy on the one hand, or highly idyllic and ethereal on the other. The boy possessed by the dreamer, like a boy possessed by some of the other shadow poles, is less than honest, though his dishonesty is usually unconscious. His isolated, ethereal behavior may mask the hidden and opposite pole of the Oedipal child's shadow, the mama's boy. What this boy really shows in a roundabout way is his pique at failing to achieve possession of the mother. His grandiosity in seeking to possess the mother is hidden by the dreamer's depression. There is much confusion about the archetype of the hero. It is generally assumed that the heroic approach to life or to a task is the noblest, but this is only partly true. The hero is, in fact, only an advanced form of boy psychology, the most advanced form, the peak, actually, of the masculine energies of the boy, the archetype that characterizes the best in the adolescent stage of development. Yet it is immature, and when it is carried over into adulthood as the governing archetype, it blocks men from full maturity. If we think about the hero as the grandstander or the bully, this negative aspect becomes clearer. The boy or man under the power of the bully intends to impress others. His strategies are designed to proclaim his superiority and his right to dominate those around him. He claims center stage as his birthright. If ever his claims to special status are challenged, watch the ensuing rageful displays. He will assault those who question what they smell as his inflation with vicious verbal and often physical abuse. These attacks against others are aimed at staving off recognition of his underlying cowardice and his deep insecurity. The man still under the influence of this negative aspect of the hero is not a team player. He is a loner. He's a hotshot junior executive, salesman, revolutionary, stock market manipulator. He's the soldier who takes unnecessary risks in combat, and if he's in a position of leadership, requires the same of his men. The man who is possessed by the grandstander bully pole of the hero's shadow has an inflated sense of his own importance and his own abilities. The hero begins by thinking that he is invulnerable, that only the impossible dream is for him, and that he can fight the unbeatable foe and win. But if the dream really is impossible, and if the foe really is unbeatable, then the hero is in for trouble. The sense of invulnerability, a manifestation of the grandstander bully and of the godlike pretensions of all these immature masculine energy forms, leaves the man under the influence of the shadow hero open to the danger of his own demise. Finally, he will shoot himself in the foot. The heroic General George Patton, though immensely imaginative, creative, and inspiring to his troops, at least at times sabotaged himself with his risk-taking, his immature competition with the British General Montgomery, and his insightful but boyishly brash remarks. Rather than being assigned a mission for which his true talent qualified him, to head the Allied invasion of Europe, for instance, he was sidelined precisely because he was a hero and not fully a warrior. As is the case with the other immature masculine archetypes, the hero is overly tied to the mother. But the hero has a driving need to overcome her. He is locked in mortal combat with the feminine, striving to conquer it and to assert his masculinity. In the medieval legends about heroes and damsels, we are seldom told what happens once the hero has slain the dragon and married the princess. We don't hear what happened in their marriage because the hero, as an archetype, doesn't know what to do with the princess once he's won her. He doesn't know what to do when things return to normal. The hero's downfall is that he doesn't know and is unable to acknowledge his own limitations. A boy or a man under the power of the shadow hero cannot really realize that he is a mortal being. Denial of death, the ultimate limitation on human life, is his specialty. In this connection, we might think for a moment about the heroic nature of our Western culture. Its main business seems to be, as is often said, the conquest of nature, its use and manipulation. Pollution and environmental catastrophe are the increasingly obvious penalties for such a brash and immature project. The field of medicine operates on the usually unspoken assumption that disease and eventually death itself can be eliminated. Our modern worldview has serious difficulty facing human limitations. When we do not face our true limitations, we are inflated, and sooner or later our inflation will be called to account. The boy possessed by the coward, the other pole of the hero's bipolar shadow, shows an extreme reluctance to stand up for himself in physical confrontations. He will usually run away from a fight, perhaps excusing himself by claiming that it's more manly to walk away. But he will feel wretched in spite of his excuses. It is not only physical fights he will avoid, however. He will tend to allow himself to be bullied emotionally and intellectually as well. When someone else is demanding or forceful with him, the boy under the power of the coward and unable to feel heroic about himself will cave in. He will easily acquiesce to pressure from others. He will feel invaded and run over like a doormat. When he's had enough of this, however, the hidden grandiosity of the grandstander bully within him will erupt and launch a violent verbal and or physical assault upon his enemy, an assault for which the other is totally unprepared. But having described the negative or shadow aspects of the grandstander and the coward, we nonetheless have to ask ourselves why the hero is present in our psyches at all. Why is this a part of our personal developmental history as men? What is the evolutionary adaptation that it serves? What the hero does is mobilize the boy's delicate ego structures to break with the mother at the end of boyhood and face the difficult task that life is beginning to assign him. The hero energies call upon the boy's masculine reserves, which will be refined as he matures, in order to establish his independence and his competence and test himself against the difficult, even hostile forces in the world. The hero enables him to establish a beachhead against the overwhelming power of the subconscious, much of which, for men at least, is experienced as feminine, as mother. The hero enables the boy to begin to assert himself and define himself as distinct from all others, so that ultimately, as a distinct being, he can relate to them fully and creatively. The hero throws the boy up against the limits, against the seemingly intractable. It encourages him to dream the impossible dream that might just be possible after all if he has enough courage. It empowers him to fight the unbeatable foe, that if he is not possessed by the hero, he might just be able to defeat. Once again, it is our position that all too often therapists, not to mention relatives, friends, co-workers, and people in positions of authority, attack, knowingly or unknowingly, the shining of the hero in men. Ours is an age of envy, in which laziness and self-involvement are the rule. Anyone who dares to stand above the crowd is dragged back down by his lackluster peers. We need a great rebirth of the heroic in our world. Every sector of human society, wherever that may be on the planet, seems to be slipping into chaos. Only a massive rebirth of courage in both men and women will rescue the world. Against enormous odds, the hero picks up his sword and charges into the heart of the abyss, into the mouth of the dragon, into the castle under the power of an evil spell. What is the end of the hero? Almost universally, in legend and myth, he dies, is transformed into a god, and translated into heaven. We recall the story of Jesus' resurrection and ascension, or of Oedipus' final disappearance in a flash of light at Colonus, or Elijah's ascent into the sky in a fiery chariot. The death of the hero is the death of boyhood, of boy psychology, and it is the birth of manhood and man psychology. The death of the hero in the life of a boy or a man really means that he has finally encountered his limitations. He has met the enemy, and the enemy is himself. He has met his own dark side, his very unheroic side. He has fought the dragon and been burned by it. He has fought the revolution and drunk the dregs of his own inhumanity. He has overcome the mother and then realized his incapacity to love the princess. The death of the hero signals a boy's or a man's encounter with true humility. It is the end of his heroic consciousness. True humility, we believe, consists of two things. The first is knowing our limitations, and the second is getting the help we need. If we are possessed by the hero, we will fall under the negative aspect of this energy and live out the inflated feelings and actions of the grandstander bully. We will walk over others in our insensitivity and arrogance, and eventually we will self-destruct, ridiculed, and cast out by others. If we are in the passive pole of the hero's bipolar shadow, possessed by the coward, we will lack the motivation to achieve anything of significance for human life. But if we access the hero energy appropriately, we will push ourselves up against our limitations. We will adventure to the frontiers of what we can be as boys, and from there, if we can make the transition, we will be prepared for our initiation into manhood. It is enormously difficult for a human being to develop to full potential. The struggle with the infantile within us exerts a tremendous gravitational pull against achieving that full adult potential. Nevertheless, we need to fight gravity by dint of hard labor, and to build the pyramids of first boyhood and then manhood that constitute the core structures of our masculine selves. The ancient Maya seldom destroyed earlier structures from their cities past. Like them, we do not want to demolish the pyramids of boyhood, for they were and will always remain generators of power and gateways to energy resources from our primordial past. But we need to get to work laying courses of stone over those old terraces and stairs. We need to build brick by brick toward the goal of mature masculinity. There are a number of techniques we can use in this construction project. Analysis of dreams, the re-entering and changing of our dreams, active imagination in which the ego, among other things, dialogues with the energy patterns within, thereby achieving both differentiation from and access to them, psychotherapy in a variety of forms, meditation on the positive aspects of the archetypes, prayer, magical ritual process with a spiritual elder, various forms of spiritual discipline, and other methods are all important to the difficult process of turning boys into men. The four major forms of the mature masculine energies that we have identified are the king, the warrior, the magician, and the lover. They all overlap and ideally enrich each other. A good king is always also a warrior, a magician, and a lover, and the same holds true for the other three. The boy energies also overlap and inform each other, as we've seen. The divine child naturally gives rise to the Oedipal child. Together they form the nucleus of whatever will be beautiful, energetic, related, warm, caring, and spiritual in the man. The boy's ego needs the precocious child's perceptiveness to help it distinguish itself from these energies. And all three give rise to the hero, which breaks them free of the domination of the feminine unconscious and establishes the boy's identity as a separate individual. The hero prepares the boy to become a man. The archetypes are mysterious entities or energy flows. They remain hidden. But we experience their effects in art, in poetry, in music, in religion, in our scientific discoveries, in our patterns of behavior and of thought and feeling. We can see something of the shapes and patterns of the archetypes through these manifestations, but we can never see the energies themselves. They overlap and interpenetrate one another, yet they can be distinguished from one another for purposes of clarification. Through active imagination, they can be remixed so that we can realize the desired balance among their influences in our own lives. Man psychology, as we have suggested, has perhaps always been a rare thing on our planet. It is certainly a rare thing today. The horrible physical and psychological circumstances under which most human beings have lived most places, most of the time, are staggering. Hostile environments always lead to the stunting, twisting, and mutating of an organism. Let us frankly admit the enormous difficulty of our situation, for it is only when we allow ourselves to see the seriousness of any problem and to admit what it is we are up against that we can begin to take appropriate action, action that will be life-enhancing for us and for others. There's a saying in psychology that we have to take responsibility for what we're not responsible for. This means that we are not responsible, as no infant is, for what happened to us to stunt us and to fixate us in our early years when our personalities were formed and when we got stuck at immature levels of masculinity. Yet it does us no good to leave things at that. Ours is a psychological age rather than an institutional one. What used to be done for us by institutional structures and through ritual process, we now have to do inside ourselves, for ourselves. Ours is a culture of the individual rather than the collective. Our Western civilization pushes us to strike out on our own, to become, as Jung said, individuated from each other. That which used to be more or less unconsciously shared by everyone, like the process of developing a mature masculine identity, we now must connect with consciously and individually. It is to this task that we now turn.